You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
What do you know?
Never gonna know, never gonna know.
What do you know?
Thank you, dear listener, for downloading yet another Dear Science podcast. I am Jonathan Golub, author of the column Dear Science and the Stranger, Stranger's science columnist. You are listening to the Dear Science podcast in a regular version. Send in your questions. They inspire the column, dearscience@thestranger.com, and our theme music is a gracious gift of the band Big Little Dipper Dipper. This week, we are going to discuss the financial meltdown. Economics is science, I believe, or at least a really sort of tawdry science, and with me is Charles Medede, associate editor of The Stranger, resident expert in zoophilia and Marxism, and as an extra treat, you will now get a hungover Marxist critique of the present financial crisis. So thank you very much, Charles, for joining us. I appreciate your time, as always, here. And I wrote a column on this, which you can read online, in which I compared modern financial securities to processed food. Someone made the metaphor I called Wall Street the Velveeta factory, and I actually think that's just about right. And so one of the ideas here, I don't know, Charles, what did you think of that? Do you think that made sense?
I thought I wasn't surprised. I was also fascinating in another sense, in Das Kapital. Marx spends a really great deal of time discussing what he calls corruption in food. And so he's talking about the amount of hair and other things that are in bread, and he goes on about at length, and I couldn't help but think that there's some relationship between Marx taking capitalism and attacking capitalism, not only because it exploits the poor, but also because it gives us food with crap in it. I mean, actual, you know what I mean? Actual.
The designated limit of crap.
Yes.
So we should carry out this metaphor and make sure it's clear. So, like, what I was kind of saying is, like, a bank giving out a mortgage to someone, like, you taking a bunch of deposits, giving out a mortgage directly to a homeowner, is kind of like a baked potato. It's very simple and straightforward, and you can kind of judge the quality of it just by kind of looking, or the checks coming in. What had been done with these financial securities that are unraveling as we speak is that they would combine together, in the case of the mortgage-backed securities, a whole bunch of mortgages, dice them up, split them up, or break them together, or try to give some sort of grading to them, and then sell them off to millions of investors. And it's sort of like, you know, like a can of Pringles. If you look under a can of Pringles, the amount of ingredients is sort of astonishing. And if you start to actually think about it for a minute, you're really trusting that every one of those ingredients is safe and good, and at least up to some level of quality. And I always thinking back to the crisis before, to the this present crisis of financial market being analogous to the crisis that almost happened when the poison pet food came out, because that was when a very commonly used ingredient was tainted. And I love that. We talked about this briefly before in a previous podcast with Jen Graves. But I just wanted that melamine scandal. The contaminated food was so beautiful because it was a very clever contamination where it was clearly intentional, where some brilliant chemist in China figured out a way of making coal waste byproduct look like protein for tests. And so, and so this is sort of like the analogous thing has absolutely happened with mortgages, you know, by doing all this dicing and sort of manipulating the bond rating agencies and all of this, we ended up with something where actually shoddy investments ended up looking better than they were for a while. So one of the points I made in my column is what contained the melamine scare was in the food markets, they're still relatively regulated, and you could go back through all the piles of paperwork that go for all those food additives and processed food and track them back to some supplier. And so they were actually able to track back the tainted wheat gluten in the pet food all the way to a factory halfway around the world in China. And no analogous thing can be done in most of these securities. So little paperwork was collected, so little care, and so little regulation exists of this market that there's no way to tell. And so even in the subprime mortgage market, the majority of people have dutifully paid their loans. There's no way to sort the bad loans from the good loans. And as a result, even the good loans are about as valueless as bad ones, because there's no way to sort them out. There's no, and this sort of speaks to the importance of regulatory systems and sort of these transparency for making these very complicated systems work. And I kind of like that. I mean, you were kind of talking about this, that there's actually something sort of radical about the notion of a true market in which information really is shared, where there's clarity and there's actually something. The financial systems that we live in are actually quite far away from the sort of Adam Smith ideal, perfect information sharing,
right,
low boundaries for entry for buyers and sellers. And so there's very specific requirements for a free market or an open market that do not exist essentially ever.
You've actually brought up something really terrifying. One wants to say, they invented, this is an invention, right? It's a way to repackage, a fiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
To make a fiction out of real money, people work, and then you convert it into a fiction and you sell it to people, and they sort of buy this fiction, and the big problem that I have is there's this, I'm always terrified of. It sort of goes against this, but it seems like there's as if there's some reality to it. So, you know what I mean? If you unravel this thing, then you'll hit reality.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there is. I don't know if there is a reality. There's something that tells me that's a little concerned about. The idea that we could trace all of this back into somebody digging a hole in the ground.
In some ways, in a disgusting way, because this sort of speaks of a sort of scientific mindset, I'm kind of excited to see this as it all unravels in a horrifying way. But it's like one of those moments that's been getting a lot of press where rice is no longer available on the shelves of Sam's Club or Costco. And it's sort of at a moment where, I think for a lot of people, the collapse of the dollar and the collapse of Bear Stearns and a lot of these large investment banks is still fairly abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And then you suddenly can't buy rice at the store. And now people are starting to hoard rice. And it's sort of this weird moment when you begin to realize that there are these staple items you just assume are going to bloom up from at the shelving at Costco suddenly actually are grown somewhere and come out of the earth. And you realize, it's sort of funny. This is the other argument I get into in this sort of the topic of unraveling, where everyone's talking about, I'm going to convert to fluorescent light bulbs, which I dislike for a bunch of reasons, and that's going to save the earth, and we're going to stop global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, looking at the objective facts, what you can kind of observe, it's done. Global warming is going to happen. Climate change is most likely going to occur. I mean, there's a whole long article that Germany and Italy are vastly expanding the amount of coal-burning power plants at the expense of oil and natural gas, because oil and natural gas got inexpensive. And far from hitting, reduced carbon targets, it's been going up every year and will continue to. And again, it's viewed as sort of an abstract problem until, the rice crop in Australia fails and suddenly there's riots and no more rice at Sam's Club. And then and it's an intriguing thing, again, this idea of information flow in these complex systems. How many people are going to be able to connect climate change and the overconsumption of fossil fuels globally to a rice crop failure in Australia to no more rice on the shelf at Sam's Club? And I think that's a relatively small chain of causal effects going through. I don't know. I mean, it's a failure. I mean, I think there's so many externalities in the market now.
But still, there's this thing which I was curious that you took up, a financial question. I mean, you think there can be a science to it? I mean, can there be? I mean, science, and it seems that there's a limit, or is it? I mean, how?
I mean,
it's hard to.
Whenever you're going down, the very core of science is that ideas are attested by experiment.
Right.
And so economics, usually the problem is a lot of the economic ideas or theories are involving, very large systems like countries or the global market. And you can do a very limited number of experiments. We do them as politicians essentially do it. So you can look at the idea of the Laffer curve, that if you drop taxes, you'll actually get more income in because people work just that much harder. This is the supply side economics that you thought maybe died during Reagan, and then it came back during the Bush years. And both times we tried this idea out, tested it by employing and seeing it's not happened. It's been proven false. And so in that sense, economics is a science, but it's very hard to model. And then there, you can mathematically model all these things, but very rarely does the real world meet any sort of textbook ideal. You know, it's like the whole other question, you know, this is maybe tangential, but the whole other question of free trade. There's a lot of talk about being pro-trade and free trade and supporting NAFTA and sort of maybe, I want to say, a little bit of condescension on the part of some of the pro-trade proponents that people like in the Midwest, like former assembly workers, don't understand the great virtues of this. And you almost want to turn around and shake. And I would say, again, looking at the science and looking at the theoretical, the idea behind a free market or a free trade, or there's only, to my knowledge, been one really large experiment in free trade in the entire world, which is the EU. Because free trade doesn't just imply open trading of goods. It also means no more currency manipulation. And it also implies free travel of people. Immigration, open immigration is as important to the theoretical benefits of free trade as open barriers to goods, no tariffs. And so you look at something like the EU where they drop the passport requirements and they fix the currencies and have a shared currency and allow goods and people and money to flow unencumbered. In a large cohesive group, and that is free trade. The World Trade Organization, NAFTA, CAFTA, the South American Free Trade, the Colombian Free Trade, none of that is anything like free trade. They're trade agreements that lower tariffs, but it's not exactly like, you know, I mean, this is the other half of it. You have one time where they're trying to push to lower barriers to goods flowing from Mexico, but at the same time trying to tighten immigration restrictions. And there's nothing free trade about that. That does not fit the theoretical requirements to receive the theoretical benefits of it. And so this is one of those intriguing moments when so what has hurt many of these line workers and manufacturing workers really isn't free trade. It's this sort of bizarre system where there's not really a fair competition. The currency manipulations alone, I mean, what China is a particularly interesting example, because a lot of China's success is not just that Chinese people are harder working or are better at making stuff, or that it's sensible to have, you know, cheap electronics or cheap manufactured goods travel half the globe. Every single thing that you want to buy loaded into a ship and shipped around the world. It is not as efficient. In fact, the marginal improvements in production are very small and are largely propped up by currency manipulations. So the only thing that China holds very tightly is the flow of dollars into the country and in the conversion of those dollars into local currency. And so by manipulating that, the Chinese actually effectively force savings on the Chinese people, which is fine and it actually makes some sense. But the net effect of that is to actually prop up, make Chinese manufacturers seem more efficient than they actually are, right? But to reduce it at a lower price because they artificially depress the value of the yuan and the Chinese currency relative to the dollar and blah, 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 blah. This is all stuff much better to be read than to have to try to listen to. And I don't have as good of a clean metaphor as I have with the processed food to natural food for it. But it's an important thing to keep in mind about it, trying to explain why our present world is so unstable. A lot of the things that we sort of take for granted, that manufacturing should be in China, that it's free trade as it has occurred, that unlimited growth in manufacturing capacity is possible with present technology. These are all assumptions that are not necessarily true. And I think when things start to wobble, that's what you're really feeling. And sometimes it's clear enough you can see what's broken below you. But a lot of times the pathways are so jangled you can't. And that complicates it. This is why, you know, in the least, I'm like, it's the same thing. Like, I'll eat processed food because I have some faith in the regulatory structure and all the smart people that are sort of keeping an eye on things as they flow together to make a Pringle or a Cheeto. But I don't have that faith in the international financial markets.
The Time magazine recently came out in an article about 10 big things that are happening in the world, right? And one of them is, like, you know, Americans are going to have to get used to living by their, you know, by their means. Like, this idea of the credit crunch is not just simply going to go away. It's a real, it has, you know, future implications. And the kind of, you know, and the fact that most people in the world live closer to what the reality of you know, things that materials of wealth, of national wealth, and that Americans have lived outside of that reality, that maybe what's its shift is not so simply so much it's almost like America returning back to the world and more by the day. And that really what's happening is that there's a sort of leveling occurring. And you may see this is bad or not in the sense that you know, that life in Argentina or life in South Africa is going to more and more level with life in, you know, in Europe and life in USA. And it's going to create sort of a global proletariat in the sense that, I want to use that, erase that word. I want to say a global sort of multitude, right? Where which will no longer. I mean, this is simply because the resources aren't there for this kind of.
This is an excellent point. This is something that I've tried to make in some of my columns going over time. And at the core of this present situation is actually a very happy story that there's an unprecedented number of people at this time on the cusp of material wealth that has been unheard of in human history. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the natural product of what the United States has kind of pushed onto the world. The more or less idea, if you cooperate and do these following things, you can live a Western lifestyle. And the conceit, the sort of underlying, again, at the very bottom of this very complicated thing, what's teetering, in my opinion, is the fact that with present technology, there are enough resources on the planet for maybe a billion or two people to live with a Western lifestyle. Not necessarily even an American lifestyle. American lifestyle, you'd probably need two, you know, it would be kind of horrifying. But just like a Western European lifestyle. And there are several billion people now on the cusp of it. You look at the BRIC countries, you know, the Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And in the updraft, I mean, the increase in material wealth in China over the past two decades has probably been the most significant event in human history since maybe the American Revolution, in a sense. And so, you know, there's much drag, and I've written a lot about sort of the negative things that have come out of China. But there's something remarkable about that, and there's something actually very joyous. But it's come at a horrific environmental cost. Mm-hmm. And this is where we can really lament the foolishness of the last decade or so. Because all of this you could kind of see, and at least some of the scientific community and some people have been sort of screaming this for a while. This is the time to get very serious. And so the way I always think about when I'm looking at a new technology is you need to be able to do, ideally, six times as much with the same amount of resource to kind of hold this bargain together. You can live the Western lifestyle if you just do these following things. And we really haven't done it. It's not to say it's impossible, but we really haven't done it. And what happens is what exactly happened. You end up in a bidding war over the lingering resources, and that makes everyone worse off.
There's a famous line in Wall Street, right? Mm-hmm. It says, greed is good. Right? My favorite line, greed is good. Right? Now, there's a sort of truth to this in a strange way. And I always think that the oil market is proof of this. For the longest time, whenever I was in Europe or when I was anywhere else, gas has always been expensive. It's never been cheap. To own, you know, to drive a car was a fancy thing. You know, it wasn't something for everybody to do. I mean, if you're well off, middle class or something, you could afford to occasionally put some gasoline in your tank and take a trip or drive somewhere. But that was considered a luxury and not a right. For the first time, Americans are getting a shock, and they're thinking that,
absolutely.
They're thinking that it's like something against them. It's like, no, if you ever just go to Canada,
it's the reality. It's just reality. I mean, it's, you know? Again, I mean, it's
so the greedy oil companies actually you know, making a profit, record profits, but in a sense, they're waking up Americans to what really most people in the world
have figured out,
yeah.
And I mean, and that kind of carries through to sort of how American, you know, like the suburban lifestyle, that you live in a place where you have to drive to everything.
Yes.
Everything. Versus like living in a city, like, you know, most European cities is the cheap housing, the crappy housing. If you don't have money, you end up way out in the suburbs and have to commute for forever. And the high value housing's on the inside. And Seattle is sort of built like this, I think, just because of the geography, not necessarily the fuel cost. But it's an intriguing thing. Most of the places where the housing prices have collapsed are these homes that are far out and you have to drive to, that actually I would say are intrinsically less valuable than things that are sort of at the core. You know, new prices and new, like the core of major cities have not taken quite the hit, with some exceptions, and I know I'll probably get a couple emails of people finding stuff, but it's I agree. I mean, it's sort of this is these financial upshakes again. I think we're coming around to this theme that it's sort of reality intruding on the fantasy. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it definitely, I think some people who have been operating on poor assumptions are going to be shocked. And I think the bottom is a far, far way away. But don't worry, we're getting that $600 check this week.
That's right.
I really think, how are you gonna spend your check, Charles? Aspirin and Pedialyte, or
buy some marijuana. Contribute to the underground economy.
I was going to say domestic underground economy.
That's right.
I buy a computer hard drive, so I'll be contributing to the foreign trade economy here.
I know that I read somewhere, or I had a conversation with a friend in New York City not too recently, mm-hmm. and he said that, you know, it's sort of terrifying because basically, the housing market, I mean, property housing, and particularly, you know, the crash, is hard for me to find sympathy with that at all, because again, this idea of unlimited, like, you know, housing development, you know, was always, again, to begin with, a very shaky proposal. I mean, it's sort of fascinating that the world in a sense fell for this myth that America's endless this endless country where houses can just grow and grow and grow and grow.
Well, but this is the intriguing thing to me is, you know, for a bubble, housing bubbles aren't bad. You get a lot of useful things regardless of how much you want to value them at. I mean, it's nice to have more places for people to live, even if they're foreclosed, and so in the end, to my mind, it was a preferable bubble to, say, the internet bubble, where you a lot of wealth went to, fancy chairs. It seemed, you know, houses seem, particularly the urban infill development that's going to, I think, retain more of its value, I think.
Yeah, I'd like to believe this. I mean, the capitalism has, it's just these bizarre contradictions, and they don't, you know, and if they're left unresolved, what you'll have is simply houses rotting, and that's, you know, I mean, which is going to be cheaper.
Houses rotting with homeless people sitting on top of them.
This is capitalism. You know, there's one of my favorite stories about capitalism is the Motorola Iridis satellites.
Oh yeah, the satellite telephone.
So that's right. And there was a big Iridium.
Was
there a big plan? And they set out a net of satellites, around 70 or so, launched them all, set them into motion, and nobody bought into the program, right? It was losing money. And it got to the point where, instead of keeping the satellites moving, it was just better to burn them in the atmosphere. And so they just turned off their brain and let 70 satellites go sliding into the atmosphere. It's, you know, spreading junk throughout, because another big problem, you know, is
space junk.
Junk just bolts flying through the sphere. So to me, these kinds of so spectacular wealth in capitalism is also masked by this spectacular waste. And so I can't see this housing glut as anything but, you know,
houses built in the middle of the prairie with no jobs, no groceries.
You'll have people sleeping on the streets here and empty homes over there, and they will never meet because they can't. The gulf is impossible.
And so on that uplifting note, I think we'll draw to close the most depressing Dear Science podcast yet. Next week we'll be covering the end of the world and maybe nuclear holocaust. I'm really sending your emails to dearscience@thestranger.com with your thoroughly depressing questions, and it's better than talking about poop. Thank you all for listening.
Take care.